eyes, he just looked like Jules, like he always did. His left hand was pressed to his side, but his right came up, his fingers curling around the back of her neck. "Em," he said again, his eyes wide and dark blue in the dim light. "Did you kiss Mark the other night?" "What?" Emma stared. "Okay, you've definitely lost too much blood." He shifted minutely under her, keeping his hand where it was, gentle, tickling the fine hairs at the nape of her neck. "I saw the way you looked at him," he said, "outside Poseidon's. If you're worried about Mark's well-being, you shouldn't be. He's a mess. I know that. I don't think he needs to be more confused." "It wasn't that. I wasn't worried about Mark." He closed his eyes as if he were counting silently inside his head. When he opened them again, his pupils were wide black circles sketched onto his irises. Maybe it should have been that, but it wasn't. Was he actually hallucinating? Emma thought in a panic. It wasn't like him to ramble like this, to make no sense at all. "I have to call the Silent Brother," she said. "I don't care if you hate me forever or the investigation gets canceled." "Please," he said, desperation clear in his voice. Just one more try." "One more," she echoed. "You'll fix this. You'll fix me, because we're Parabatai. We're forever. I said that to you once, do you remember?" She nodded warily, hand on the phone. "And the strength of a rune your Parabatai gives you is special. Whatever was on that arrowhead was meant to prevent healing magic, but Emma, you can do it. You can heal me. We're Parabatai. And that means the things we can do together are extraordinary." There was blood on her jeans now, blood on her hands and her tank top. He was still bleeding, the wound still open, an incongruous tear in the smooth skin all around it. "Try," Jules said in a dry whisper. "For me, try." His voice went up on the question, and in it she heard the voice of the boy he had been once, remembered him smaller, skinnier, younger, standing upright before his siblings in the great hall in Alicante, as his father advanced on him with his blade unsheathed. And she remembered what Julian had done then, done to protect her, to protect all of them, because he always would do everything to protect them. She took her hand off the phone and gripped the steely so tightly she felt it dig into her damp palm. "Look at me, Jules," she said, and he met her eyes with his. She placed the steely against his skin, and for a moment she held still, just breathing. Breathing and remembering. Julian, a presence in her life for as long as she could recall, splashing water at each other in the ocean, digging in the sand together, putting his hand over hers and then marveling at the difference in the shape and length of their fingers. Julian singing, terribly and off-key, while he drove his fingers in her hair carefully freeing a trapped leaf, his hands catching her in the training room when she fell and fell and fell. The first time after their Parabatai ceremony, when she'd smashed her hand into a wall in rage at not being able to get a sword maneuver right, and he'd come up to her, taken her still shaking body in his arms, and said, "Emma, Emma, don't hurt yourself. When you do, I feel it too." Something in her chest seemed to split and crack. She marveled that it wasn't audible. Energy raced along her veins, and the steely moved in her hand, tracing the graceful outline of a healing rune across Julian's chest. She heard him gasp. His eyes flying open, his hands slid down her back, and he pressed her against him, his teeth gritted. "Don't stop," he said. Emma couldn't have stopped if she wanted to. The steely seemed to be moving of its own accord. She was blinded with memories, a kaleidoscope of them, all of Julian. Sun in her eyes, and Julian asleep on the beach in an old T-shirt, and her not wanting to wake him. But he'd woken anyway when the sun went down, and looked for her immediately, not smiling till his eyes found her, and he knew she was there. Falling asleep talking and waking up with their hands interlocked. They'd been children in the dark together once, but now they were something else, something intimate and powerful. Something Emma felt she was touching only the very edge of as she finished the rune and the steely fell from her fingers. "Oh," she said softly. The rune seemed lit from within by a soft glow. Julian was breathing hard, his stomach muscles rising and falling quickly, but the bleeding had stopped. The wound was closing, sealing itself up like an envelope. Does it hurt? A smile was spreading across Julian's face. His hand was still on Emma's hip, gripping hard. He must have forgotten. "No," he said. His voice was hushed, soft, as if he were speaking inside a church. "You did it. You fixed it." He was looking at her like she was a rare miracle. "Emma, my God. Emma." Emma slumped against his shoulder as the tension drained out of her. She let her head rest there as his arms circled her body. "It's all right." He slid his hands down her back, clearly able to tell that she was shaking. "Everything's fine. I'm fine." "Jules," she whispered. His face was close to hers. She could see the light freckles across his cheekbones under the smears of blood. She could feel his body against hers, vividly alive, the slamming of his heart in his ribcage and the heat of his skin, as if on fire from the power of the Arazi. Her own heart was beating hard as her hands found his shoulders. The front door of the car flew open. Light streamed in, and Emma jerked away from Julian as Livy clambered into the front seat. Livy was holding a witchlight in her right hand, and its irregular beams illuminated the strange scene in the back of the Toyota. Emma in her bloody clothes, Julian shirtless, jammed against the rear door. His hands fell away from Emma. "Is everything okay?" Livy demanded. She was gripping her phone in one hand. She must have been waiting for more messages, Emma felt guiltily. "You texted 911. "Everything's fine," Emma slid across the bench seat, away from Jules. He struggled upright, looking down dubiously at his shredded shirt. "Someone shot me with a crossbow bolt. The Arazis weren't working." "Well, you look fine now," Livy eyed him puzzled. "Bloody, but..." "A little parabatine magic," said Jules. "They weren't working, then they were. Sorry to scare you." "It looks like a mad science lab back here." There was relief on Livy's face. "Who shot you, anyway?" "It's a long story," said Jules. "How did you get here? You didn't drive, did you?" Another head suddenly appeared beside Livy's. Mark, his blonde hair haloed in the witchlight. "I drove," he announced, "upon a fairy steed." "What? But your fairy steed was shredded by demons."
"There are as many fairy steeds as there are riders," Mark said, looking pleased to be mysterious. "I did not say it was my fairy steed. Just a fairy steed."
Mark disappeared from his side of the car. Before Emma could determine where he'd gone, the door behind Julian flew open. Mark leaned in, picked up his younger brother bodily, and lifted him out of the car. "What?" Emma seized her steely and scrambled out after them. There were two more figures standing on the asphalt of the parking lot, Christina and Ty, illuminated by the lights of a motorcycle. In fact, the whole motorcycle was glowing. It wasn't Mark's. It was black with a painted design of horns on the chassis.
"Jules?"
Ty looked blanched and frightened as Julian pulled free of Mark's grip, yanking down the tattered remains of his shirt. Christina hurried over to Emma as Julian turned to his younger brother.
"Ty, everything's all right," he said.
"I'm fine."
"But you're covered in blood," said Ty. He wasn't looking directly at Julian, but Emma couldn't help wondering if he was remembering the dark war and the blood and the dying all around him. People have only so much blood they can lose before...
"I'll get some blood replacement runes," said Julian.
"Remember, Ty, we're shadow hunters. We can handle a lot."
"You're covered in blood, too," Christina murmured to Emma, shrugging off her own jacket. She slung it around Emma's shoulders, covering her bloody tank. She brushed her hands through Emma's hair, looking at her worriedly. "You're sure you're not hurt?"
"Julian's blood," Emma whispered, and Christina made a murmuring noise and pulled Emma into a hug. She patted Emma's back, and Emma hung on to her for dear life, and decided there and then that if anyone ever tried to hurt Christina, she would grind them to a pulp and make amusing sandcastles out of them. Livy had moved to stand next to Ty and was holding his hand, murmuring to him that blood was just blood. Julian wasn't hurt. Everything was fine. Ty was breathing quickly, his hand opening and closing over Livy's.
"Here." Mark shrugged out of his blue T-shirt. He was wearing another T-shirt under it, this one gray.
Julian blinked at him.
"Proper vestments." He offered it to his brother.
"Why are you wearing a T-shirt under your other T-shirt?" Livy asked, temporarily diverted.
"In case one of them is stolen," Mark said as if this were entirely normal. Everyone paused to stare at him, even Julian, who had stripped off the rags of his shirt and covered himself with Mark's.
"Thanks," Julian said, pulling Mark's shirt down over his belt.
He tossed the scraps of his old shirt on top of a dumpster. Mark seemed pleased and, Emma realized belatedly, looked different. His hair was no longer hanging past his shoulders, but was cut short, or shorter, curling around his ears. It made him look both younger and more modern, less incongruous in his jeans and boots. More like a shadow hunter. Mark looked back. She could still see the wind in his eyes, and the stars, and vast fields of empty clouds. Wildness and freedom. She wondered how deep his transformation back into a shadow hunter ran. How deep it would ever run. She put a hand to her head.
"I feel dizzy."
"You need food."
It was Livy grabbing her hand. "We all do.
Nobody's eaten tonight, and Jules, you're forbidden from cooking. Let's go to Cantor's, grab some dinner, and figure out what to do next. Everything inside Cantor's was yellow. The walls were yellow, the booths were yellow, and most of the food was a shade of yellow. Not that Emma minded. She had been coming to Cantor's since she was 4 years old with her parents to eat their chocolate chip pancakes and challah French toast. They piled into a corner booth, and for a few minutes everything was absolutely ordinary. The waitress, a tall woman with gray hair, came by to dump a pile of laminated menus on their table. Livy and Ty shared one, and Christina asked Emma, in a whisper, what matzah brie was. They were scrunched together in the booth, and Emma found herself pressed up against Julian's side. He felt hot against her, as if the Arazi hadn't worked its way out of his system yet. Her skin still felt supersensitized, too, as if she would jump or scream the moment someone touched her. She nearly did scream when the waitress returned to get their orders. She just stared until Julian ordered waffles and hot chocolate for her and handed the menu back hastily, looking at her worriedly.
A-R-E-Y-O-U-A-L-L-R-I-G-H-T?
He scribbled on her back. She nodded, reaching for her plastic glass of ice water, just as Mark smiled at the waitress and ordered a plate of strawberries. The waitress, whose name tag said Jean, blinked.
We don't have that on the menu.
But you do have strawberries on the menu, said Mark. And I've seen plates being carried to and fro, so it stands to reason that the strawberries could be placed upon a plate and brought to me.
Jean stared.
He has a point, said Ty. Strawberries are offered as a topping in several dishes. Surely you could separate them out. A plate of strawberries?
Jean repeated. I would take them in a bowl, said Mark with a winning gaze. It has been many years since I have eaten freely at my choice, fair one, and a plate of strawberries is all that I desire.
Jean looked dazed. Right, she said, and disappeared with the menus.
Mark, said Julian, was that necessary?
Was what necessary?
You don't have to sound like a medieval fairy poem, Julian said. You sound perfectly normal half the time. Maybe we should discuss keeping a low profile?
I cannot help it, Mark said with a small smile. It's something about mundanes.
You need to act more like a normal human being, said Jules, when we're out in public.
He doesn't need to act normal, said Ty sharply.
He bumped into a payphone and said, Excuse me, miss, on our way in, said Julian.
It's polite to apologize, said Mark with the same small smile.
Not to inanimate objects.
All right, enough, said Emma.
She filled them in quickly on the events of Stanley Wells' house, including Ava's body and the mysterious figure on the roof.
So she was dead, but it was nothing like the other murders, Livy asked with a frown. It seems unrelated. No markings, body dumped in a pool outside her own house, not at a ley line.
What about the guy on the roof, Christina said. Do you think he's the killer?
Doubt it, said Emma. He had a crossbow, and none of them have been killed with crossbows.
But he hurt Jules. So when we track him down, I'm going to chop him up and feed him to my fish.
You don't have fish, Julian said.
Well, I'm going to buy some, said Emma.
I'm going to buy goldfish and feed them blood until they acquire a taste for human flesh.
That's disgusting, said Livy. Does this mean we still need to return to Wells's house and search it?
As long as we check the roof first, said Emma.
We can't, Ty said.
He held up his phone.
I was looking at the news. Someone called in the body. The mundane police are crawling all over the place. We won't be able to get anywhere near it for a few days at least. Emma blew out an exasperated breath.
Well, she said,
at least we have this.
And she reached behind her to grab Ava's bag.
She upended it on the table and the contents rattled out. Wallet, makeup case, lip balm, mirror, hairbrush, and something flat, golden and shiny.
No phone, Ty observed, a line of annoyance gathering between his brows.
Emma didn't blame him. He could have done a lot with the phone. Too bad. It was at the bottom of Wells's pool.
What's this? Livy picked up the shining square. It was blank.
Not sure.
Emma flicked through the wallet. Credit cards, driver's license, about $11 in cash. That made her feel a little queasy. Taking evidence was one thing, taking cash was another. Not that they could have returned it to Ava.
No photos or anything? Julian asked, looking over her shoulder.
I don't think people keep photos in their wallets except in movies, Emma said. Not since iPhones.
Speaking of movies, Livy furrowed her brow, looking briefly, as she did sometimes, like Ty.
This thing looks like the Golden Ticket, you know, from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. She waved the shiny piece of laminated paper. Let me see it.
Christina held out her hand.
Livy gave it to her as the waitress returned with their food. Grilled cheese for Ty, a turkey sandwich for Christina, a BLT for Julian, waffles for Emma and Livy, and Mark's plate of strawberries. Christina took out her steely and scribbled, humming, on a corner of the gold paper. Mark, looking beatific, took the dispenser of maple syrup off the table and upended it over his strawberries. He picked one up and put it in his mouth, stem and all. Julian stared at him.
What? Mark said. This is a perfectly normal thing to eat.
Sure it is, said Julian, if you're a hummingbird. Mark raised an eyebrow.
Look, Christina said, and pushed the golden paper toward the middle of the table. It was no longer blank. Instead, it featured the shimmering photo of a building, and beside it, words in block letters. The followers of the Guardian invite you to the lottery. This month's performance, August 11th, 7 p.m., the Midnight Theater. This ticket admits one group, semi-formal attire.
The lottery, Julian echoed. That's the name of a famous horror story. Do they make it into a play or something?
It doesn't sound like a play, said Livy. It sounds creepy.
It could be a creepy play, said Ty.
It was a creepy story. Julian picked up the ticket. There was paint under his fingernails, shimmering small crescents of blue.
And the creepiest thing about this is that this theater is shut down. I know the place. It's up past Highland Park. It's been shut down for years.
16 years, said Ty. He had mastered the art of using his phone one-handed and was squinting at the screen. Shut down after a fire and never rebuilt.
I've driven past it, Emma said. It's all boarded up, isn't it?
Julian nodded.
I painted it once. I was painting abandoned buildings, places like the Murphy Ranch, closed businesses. I remember that one. It had a ghostly feel.
It's interesting, Mark said. But does it have anything to do with the investigation, the murders?
Everyone looked mildly surprised that Mark had asked something so practical.
I think it might, Emma said. I was at the Shadow Market last week.
I wish you'd quit going to the Shadow Market, Julian muttered. It's dangerous there.
Oh, no, Emma said. Not danger. Mr. I just almost bled out in my car.
Julian sighed and reached for his soda. I can't believe I ever complained about Jules as a nickname.
Maybe we should talk about the Shadow Market, said Christina hastily. It is where Emma first heard information about the murders.
Well, you can imagine how happy the marketers were to see me and Cameron.
You went with Cameron, Julian said. Livy held up a hand.
In Emma's defense, Cameron's annoying, but he's hot.
Julian gave her a look.
I mean, if you like guys who look like a redheaded Captain America, which I don't.
Captain America is definitely the most handsome Avenger, said Christina.
But I like the Hulk.
I would like to heal his broken heart.
We're Nephilim, said Julian. We're not even supposed to know about the Avengers. Besides, he added, Iron Man is obviously the best looking.
Can I finish my story? Emma demanded. I was at the market with Cameron, and I remember now I saw a booth that had a placard up that said something like, sign up for the lottery. So I think it's something supernatural, not experimental theater or whatever.
I have no idea who the Avengers are, observed Mark, who had finished his strawberries and was eating sugar out of a packet.
Ty looked gratified. He had no time for superheroes.
But I agree with you. This is a lead. Someone murdered Stanley Wells, and now his girlfriend is dead, too. Even if it is in a completely different way.
I think we can all agree it can't be a coincidence, said Emma. Them both dying.
I don't think it is, said Mark. But she could have been killed because she knew something, not because she was a sacrifice like he was or part of the same ritual. Death breeds death, after all. He looked thoughtful. She was invited to this lottery performance. She thought it was important enough to carry the ticket around with her. I think it could be a thread to follow.
Or it could be nothing, said Jules. We don't have much else to investigate, pointed out Emma.
We do, actually, said Jules. We've still got your photos from the inside of the cave at the convergence. And now we have whoever was at Wells' house and shot at me. We've still got my gear jacket with whatever poison he used on it.
Maybe Malcolm could look into that. Find out if it's associated with a particular demon or warlock who might sell it.
Great, Emma said. We can do both.
August 11th is tomorrow night, she found out the ticket.
Oh, God, semi-formal. Fancy. I don't think I have any dresses that fancy, and Mark will need a suit.
Mark doesn't have to go, Julian said quickly. He can stay at the Institute.
No, Mark said. His voice was calm, but his eyes sparked.
I will not. I was brought here to help you investigate these murders, and that is what I will do.
Julian sat back. Not if we can't rune you, it's not safe.
I have protected myself without runes for many years. If I do not go with you, then those in Faerie who sent me here will learn of it, and they will not be pleased. The punishment will be severe.
Oh, let him go, Livy said, looking anxious. Jules. Julian touched the edge of his shirt, the gesture half unconscious. How will they know to punish you, he said, if you don't tell them?
You think it is easy to lie when you have grown up around people who do not lie, Mark said, cheeks flushing with anger. And do you think they do not have their own ways to ferret out lies when humans tell them?
You're human, Julian said hotly. You're not one of them. You don't act like one of them. Mark flung himself up from the table and stalked across the room. What's he doing? Emma stared. Mark had made his way to a neighboring table of pierced and tattooed mundane girls who looked like they'd just come from a nightclub and were giggling madly as he talked to them.
By the angel.
Julian threw down some money on the table and scrambled to his feet, ducking out of the booth. Emma scraped everything back into Ava's handbag and hastily followed Julian, the others at her heels.
Might I make free with your lettuce, my lady? Mark was saying to a girl with bright pink hair and a pile of salad on her plate.
She pushed it toward him, grinning. You're gorgeous, she said. Even with the fake elf ears. Forget the lettuce. You can make free with my... All right, you've made your point enough. Julian took Mark, who was cheerfully eating a baby carrot, by the wrist and tried to draw him toward the door. Sorry, ladies, he said as a chorus of protests rose. The girl with pink hair stood up. If he wants to stay, he can stay, she said. Who are you, anyway?
I'm his brother, Julian said.
Boy, do you two not look alike, she said in a way that made Emma bristle.
She'd called Mark gorgeous. Julian was just as gorgeous, just in a quieter, less flashy way. He didn't have Mark's sharp cheekbones or fairy charm, but he had luminous eyes and a beautiful mouth that... She goggled at herself. What was wrong with her? What was wrong with her thoughts?
Livy made an exasperated noise, stomped forward, and seized Mark by the back of the shirt. You don't want him, she said to the pink-haired girl. He has syphilis. The girl stared. Syphilis? 5% of people in America have it, said Ty helpfully.
I do not have syphilis, Mark said angrily. There are no sexually transmitted diseases in Fairyland.
The mundane girls fell instantly silent. Sorry, Jules said. You know how syphilis is. Attacks the brain. The table of girls were open-mouthed as Livy hauled Mark by his shirt through the restaurant and into the parking lot, the rest of them following. The moment they were outside and the door had closed behind them, Emma burst out laughing. She leaned against Christina, who was also giggling, as Livy let go of Mark and smoothed down her skirt, looking unruffled. Sorry, Emma said. It's just... syphilis? Ty was reading about it today, said Livy. Julian, who had been trying to hide a smile, looked over at Ty. Why have you been reading about syphilis? Ty shrugged.
Research. Was that really necessary? Mark demanded. I was merely making conversation. I thought I would practice my gentry speech on them.
You were being ridiculous on purpose, said Emma. I'm beginning to get the feeling you think fairies sound silly.
I did at first, said Mark candidly. Then you get used to it. Now I don't know what to think. He sounded a little lost.
We're not supposed to talk to mundanes, Julian said, his smile vanishing. It's basic, Mark. One of the first things we learn, especially not about things like Fairyland.
I spoke to those mundanes, and no one exploded or caught on fire, said Mark.
No doom came down upon us.
They thought I was wearing a costume.
He ducked his head and then looked up at Julian.
You're right that I will stand out, but people see what they want to see.
Maybe the rules about not going out in battle without runes are stupid rules, said Ty, and Emma thought of the way Mark had spoken to Ty in the training room.
Now we both have hurt hands.
Maybe a lot of the rules are stupid rules, said Julian, and there was an edge of bitterness in his voice that surprised Emma. Maybe we just have to follow them anyway. Maybe that's what makes us shadow hunters. Livy looked puzzled. Having to follow the stupid rules makes us shadow hunters?
Not the rules, said Julian. The penalty for breaking them.
The penalty for breaking the rules of Faerie are just as severe, if not more so, said Mark.
You must trust me on this, Julian. If they think I am not part of the investigation, they will punish not just me, but also all of you. They do not require me to tell them. They will know. His eyes burned. You understand me?
I understand, Mark. And I trust you. Julian smiled at his brother. Then, unexpectedly, that smile that was all the more bright for its unpredictability.
Anyway, everyone into the car, okay? We're heading back.
I must return with the steed, said Mark. I cannot leave him, it, here.
If it were lost, the wild hunt would take it amiss.
Fine, said Julian. Take it back home. Ty and Livy aren't getting onto it again, understood? Too dangerous.
Livy looked disappointed. Ty, relieved.
Mark nodded almost imperceptibly.
I'll go with Mark, Christina said suddenly.
Emma saw Mark's face light up in a way that surprised her.
I shall fetch the steed, Mark said.
I find I desire to fly.
And go the speed limit, Julian yelled as Mark disappeared around the side of the building.
It's the sky, Julian, said Emma. There isn't really a speed limit.
I know, he said and smiled.
It was a smile Emma loved, the one she felt like was just for her, the one that said that although life often forced him to be serious, Julian wasn't actually serious by nature. She wanted to hug him suddenly or touch his shoulder so badly that she forced her hands down and clasped them together. She looked down at her fingers. For some reason, she had intertwined them, as if they made a cage that would hold her feelings in.
The moon was high and full in the sky when Mark brought the motorcycle to a gentle stop in the sand behind the Institute. The trip into the city had been all panic, Livy gripping onto Christina's belt with small, worried hands, Ty telling Mark not to go too fast, the freeway disappearing under their feet. They'd nearly crashed into the dumpster in the parking lot. The way back was quiet, Christina holding Mark lightly around the waist, thinking about how close they seemed to be flying to the clouds. The city below them was an interlocking pattern of colored lights. Christina had always hated amusement park rides and airplane flights, but this was like neither of those. She felt a part of the air, buoyed up by it like a small craft on the water. Mark slid off the cycle and held out his hand to help her down after him. She took it, her eyes still full of the sight of the Santa Monica Pier below them, the bright lights of the turning Ferris wheel. She never felt so far away from her mother, from the Institute in Mexico City, from the Rosaleses. She liked it.
My lady, he said as her feet touched the sand.
She felt her lips curl up.
That seems so formal.
The courts are nothing if not formal, he agreed.
Thank you for coming back with me. You didn't have to.
You seem like maybe you didn't want to be alone, Christina said. The soft wind was blowing off the desert, moving the sand, lifting his newly cut hair away from his face. Short now, it looked like a halo, so pale blonde as to be almost silver.
You see a great deal.
His eyes studied her face. She wondered what he had looked like when both of his eyes had been blackthorn eyes, blue-green as the sea. She wondered if the strangeness of his eyes now added to his beauty.
When no one you know tells the truth, you learn to see under the surface, she said, and thought of her mother and the yellow petals of roses.
Yes, he said. But then, I come from a place where everyone tells the truth, no matter how dreadful.
Is that something you miss about Fairy? Christina asked.
That there were no lies there.
How did you know I miss Fairy?
Your heart is not settled here, said Christina. And I think it is more than just familiarity that draws you back. You spoke of feeling free there, but then you also said that they cut runes into your back. I'm trying to understand how that can be something you could miss.
That was the Unseelie Court, not the hunt, said Mark.
And I cannot speak of what I miss. I cannot speak of the hunt, not truly. It is forbidden.
That is terrible. How can you choose if you cannot speak of your choice?
The world is terrible, said Mark tonelessly. And some are drawn down into it and drown there, and some rise above and carry others with them. But not very many. Not everyone can be Julian.
Julian? Christina was startled. But I thought perhaps you didn't even like him. I thought...
You thought... He arched his silvery eyebrows. I thought you didn't like any of us, she said sheepishly.
It seemed a foolish thing to say, but his face softened. He reached to take her hand, brushing his own fingers along her palm. A shiver raced up her arm. The touch of his hand was like an electric current.
I like you, he said.
Christina Mendoza Rosales,
I like you very much.
He leaned down toward her. His eyes filled her vision, blue and gold.
Mark Blackthorne.
The voice that spoke his name was sharp, clipped. Both Christina and Mark whirled around. The tall fairy warrior who had brought Mark to the Institute stood in front of them, as if he had simply evolved out of the black and white sand and sky. He looked black and white himself, his hair the color of ink curling darkly against his temples,
His silver eye glowed in the moonlight. His black eye looked pupilless. He wore a gray tunic and trousers and daggers at his belt. He was as inhumanly lovely as a statue.
"Kieran," said Mark, a sort of half-shocked exhale, "but I
should have expected me."
Kieran stalked forward.
"You asked to borrow my steed. I lent it. The longer I go without it, the more chary Gwyn will grow."
"Did you hope to raise his suspicions?" "I intended to return it," Mark said, his voice low.
"Did you?"
Kieran crossed his arms over his chest. "Christina, go inside," said Mark. He had dropped his hand and was looking at Kieran, not at her, his expression fixed.
"Mark, please," he said. "This is...
if you respect my privacy, please go inside." She hesitated, but his expression was clear. He knew what he was asking. She turned and went in through the Institute's back door, letting it bang loudly shut behind her. The stairs loomed up in front of her, but she couldn't climb them. She barely knew Mark Blackthorne, but as she went to put her foot on the first step, she thought of the scars on his back, of the way he had curled into a ball in his bedroom that first day, the way he had accused Julian of being a dream or a nightmare sent to haunt him by the Wild Hunt. She didn't believe in the cold peace, had never believed in it, but Mark's pain had torn away at her beliefs. Perhaps the fairies truly were that cruel. Perhaps there really was no good in them, no honor. And if that was the case, how could she leave Mark out there alone with one of them? She whirled around and pushed the door open and froze. It took a moment for her gaze to find them, but when it did, Mark and Kieran seemed to leap out at her like the images from a lighted screen. They stood in a patch of moonlight at the edge of the lot, Mark's back against one of the scrub oak trees. Kieran was leaning against him, pinning him to the tree, and they were kissing. Christina hesitated a moment, blood rising into her face, but it was clear Mark wasn't being touched against his will. Mark's hands were tangled in Kieran's hair, and he was kissing him as fiercely as if he were starving. Their bodies were pressed together tightly. Nevertheless, Kieran clutched at Mark's waist, his hands moving restlessly, desperately, as if he could pull Mark closer still. They slid up, pushing Mark's jacket off his shoulders, stroking the skin at the edge of his collar. He made a low, keening sound like the cry of grief deep in his throat and broke away. He was staring at Mark, his gaze as hungry as it was hopeless. Never had a fairy looked so human to Christina as Kieran did then. Mark looked back at him, eyes wide, shining in the moonlight. A shared look of love and longing and terrible sadness. It was too much. It had already been too much. Christina knew she shouldn't have been watching them, but she hadn't been able to stop. Mingled shock and fascination rooting her to the spot. And desire. There was desire, too. Whether for Mark or for both of them, or just the idea of wanting someone so much she wasn't sure. She moved back, her heart pounding, about to pull the door shut after her. And the whole parking lot lit up like a stadium as a car rounded the corner and turned into it. Music blared out the windows. Christina could hear Emma's and Julian's voices. Her gaze darted back toward Mark and Kieran. But Kieran had vanished, a shadow into shadows. Mark was bending down to pick up his jacket as Emma and the others piled out of the car. Christina pulled the door shut. Through it, she heard Emma ask Mark where she was, and Mark say that she had gone inside. He sounded casual, calm, as if nothing had happened. But everything had happened. She had wondered, when he'd looked in her eyes and said that he'd had to make do without mirrors in the Wild Hunt, whose eyes he'd been looking into for all those years. Now she knew. The Wild Hunt, some years ago. Mark Blackthorne came to the Wild Hunt when he was 16 years old, and not because he wanted to. He remembered only darkness after he had been taken from the Institute that was his home, before he awoke in underground caverns amid lichen and dripping moss. A massive man with eyes of two different colors was standing over him, carrying a horned helmet. Mark recognized him, of course. You couldn't be a shadow hunter and not know about the Wild Hunt. You couldn't be half fairy and not have read about Gwyn, the hunter, who had led the hunt for centuries. He wore a long blade of hammered metal at his waist, blackened and twisted as if it had been through many fires.
"Mark Blackthorne," he said, "you are with the hunt now, for your family is dead. We are your bloodkin now.
and drawing the sword, he sliced across his palm until he drew blood, and dripped it into water for Mark to drink. In the years to come, Mark would see others come to the hunt, and Gwyn say the same thing to them and watch them drink his blood. And he would watch their eyes change, splintering into two different colors as if to symbolize the division of their souls. Gwyn believed a new recruit had to be broken down to be built back up again as a hunter. Someone who could ride through the night without sleep. Someone who could suffer hunger that was close to starvation and endure pain that would break a mundane. And he believed their loyalty must be unswerving. They could choose no one over the hunt. Mark gave his loyalty to Gwyn and his service, but he did not make friends among the Wild Hunt. They were not shadow hunters, and he was a shadow hunter. The others were all of the fairy courts, pressed into service with the hunt as punishment. They did not like the fact that he was Nephilim, and he felt their scorn and scorned them in turn. He rode through the nights alone, on a silver mare given to him by Gwyn. Gwyn seemed perversely to like him, perhaps despite the others of the hunt. He taught Mark to navigate by the stars, and to listen for the sounds of a battle that might echo through hundreds, even thousands of miles, cries of anger and the shouts of the dying. They would ride to the field of battle and, invisible to mundane eyes, divest the dead bodies of precious things. Most of them were paid in tribute to the Seelie and Unseelie courts, but some Gwyn kept for himself. Mark slept alone, every night, on the cold ground, wrapped in a blanket, a stone for his pillow. When it was cold, he shivered and dreamed of runes that would warm him, of the hot blaze of seraph blades. In his pocket, he kept the witch-light runestone Jace Herondale had given him, though he dared not light it except when he was alone. Each night as he fell asleep, he recited the names of his sisters and brothers, in order of age. Each word was weighted like an anchor, cleaving him to the earth, keeping him alive. Helen, Julian, Tiberius, Livia, Drusilla, Octavian. The days blurred into months. Time was not like it was in the mundane world. Mark had given up counting days. There was no way to mark them down, and Gwyn hated such things. Therefore, he had no idea how long he had been with the hunt when Kieran came. He had known they were getting a new hunter. Gossip spread quickly, and besides, Gwyn always turned the newest of them in the same place, a cavern near to the entrance of the Unseelie Court, where the walls were thickly carpeted in emerald lichen and a small natural pool welled among the rocks. They found him there when they arrived, left for Gwyn to discover. At first, all Mark could see was the outline of a boy with a tangle of black hair and a slender body, the chains binding his wrists and ankles pulling into it a strange torsion. He appeared to be all bones and angles. "Prince Kieran," said Gwyn as he approached the boy, and a murmur ran through the hunt. If the newcomer was a prince, he was more exalted than fairy gentry. And what could a prince have done to get himself so brutally exiled from the court, cut off from family and name, kith and kin? The boy lifted his head when Gwyn came to him, revealing his face. He was certainly gentry. He had their strange, luminous, almost inhumanly beautiful features, high-cheekboned and black-eyed. His hair had a sheen to it of blue and green among the black, the color of the ocean at night. He turned his face away when Gwyn tried to press the water on him, mixed with blood, but Gwyn forced it down his throat. Mark watched in fascination as Kieran's right eye turned from black to silver, and the chains fell away from lacerated wrists and ankles. "You are of the hunt now," said Gwyn with a grimness that was unusual. "Rise and join us." Kieran was a strange addition to the group. Though his rank as prince had been stripped from him when he was exiled to the hunt, he still carried an indefinable air of arrogance and royalty with him, which did not sit well with the others. They mocked him, called him princeling, and would have done worse if Gwyn had not stayed their hands. It seemed there was someone in the courts looking out for Kieran, despite his exile. Mark could not help but watch him. Something about Kieran fascinated him. He soon learned that the prince's hair changed color depending on his mood, from night black, when he was despairing, to pale blue, when he laughed, which was not often. Always colors of the sea. It was thick and curling, and sometimes Mark wanted to touch it and see if it felt like hair or something else. Shot silk, a fabric that changed color in the light. Kieran rode his horse, given to him by Gwyn. It was the fiercest Mark had ever seen, black and skeletal, a mount of the dead, as if he were born to it. Like Mark, he seemed determined to ride out the pain of exile and friendlessness alone, rarely speaking to the others of the hunt, rarely even glancing at them. Only he looked at Mark sometimes, when the others called him Nephilim and Shadow Spawn and Angel Boy and other names much worse. A day came when news spread that the Clave had hanged a group of fairies in Idris for treason. The fairies had had friends among the hunt, and in a rage Mark's fellows demanded that Mark kneel and say the words, "I am not a shadow hunter." When he would not, they stripped Mark's shirt from his body and whipped him bloody. They left him crumpled under a tree in a snowy field, his blood turning the white flakes to red. When he woke, there was firelight and warmth, and he was lying in someone's lap. Only groggily did he come to enough consciousness to realize that it was Kieran's. Kieran lifted him in his arms and gave him water and folded a blanket around his shoulders. His touch was gentle and light. "I believe among your people," he said, "there are healing runes." "Yes," Mark said in a croak, moving only very slightly. Pain from his lacerated skin jolted through him. "They're called Irazis. One would mend these injuries for me, but they cannot be made without a steely, and my steely was broken years past." "That is a pity," said Kieran. "I believe your skin will be scarred forevermore."
"What care I?" said Mark, listless. "It is not as if it matters much, here in the hunt, whether I am beautiful."
Kieran gave a secret half-smile at that and touched Mark's hair lightly. Mark closed his eyes. It had been years since anyone had touched him, and the feeling sent shivers down through his body despite the pain of the cuts. After that, when they rode out together. Kieran made of the hunt an adventure for the two of them. He showed Mark wonders that only the fair folk knew of, sheets of ice lying silent and silver under moonlight, and hidden glens, blooming with night flowers. They rode among the spray of waterfalls and amid the towers of clouds, and Mark was, if not happy, no longer tortured by loneliness. At night they slept curled together under Kieran's blanket, made of a thickly woven material that was always warm. One night they stopped on a hilltop, in a place green and north. There was a cairn of stones crowning the hill, something built by mundanes 1,000 years back. Mark leaned against the side of it and looked out over the green country, silvering in the dark to the distant sea. The sea, everywhere, he thought, was the same sea that broke against the shores in the place he still thought of as home.
"Your scars have healed," Kieran said, touching one of his light, slender fingers to a torn place in Mark's shirt where the skin showed through. "But they are still ugly," Mark said.
He was waiting for the first stars to come out so he could name his family on them. He didn't see Kieran draw closer until the other boy was opposite him, his face elegantly shadowed in the twilight.
"Nothing about you is ugly," Kieran said.
He leaned in to kiss Mark, and Mark, after a moment of surprise, turned his face up and met Kieran's lips with his. It was the first time he had ever been kissed, and he had never thought it would be by a boy, but he was glad it was Kieran. He had never expected a kiss to be so agonizing and pleasurable at the same time. He had wanted to touch Kieran's hair for months, and now he did, burying his fingers in the strands, which were turning from black to blue edged with gold. They felt like licks of flame against his skin. They curled up under the blanket together that night, but they got little sleep. And Mark forgot to number the names of his family on the stars, for that night and most nights after. Soon Mark grew used to waking with his arm thrown over Kieran's body, or his hand tangled in blue-white curls. He learned that kisses and touches and professions of love could make you forget, and that the more he was with Kieran, the more he wanted to be with him, and not with anyone else. He lived for the time they were alone together, usually at night, whispering so no one could overhear them.
"Tell me of the Unseelie Court," Mark would say.
And Kieran would murmur tales of the Dark Court and the Pale King, his father, who ruled over it.
and "Tell me of the Nephilim," Kieran would say. And Mark would speak of the angel and of the dark war and what had happened to him, and of his brothers and sisters. "You don't hate me?" Mark said, lying in Kieran's arms, somewhere in a high alpine meadow. His unkempt blonde hair brushed against Kieran's shoulder as he turned his head. "For being Nephilim?" "The others do." "You need not be Nephilim anymore. You could choose to be of the Wild Hunt. Embrace your fairy nature." Mark shook his head. "When they beat me for saying I was a shadow hunter, it only made me more sure. I know what I am, even if I cannot say it." "You can say it only to me," said Kieran, his long fingers ghosting across Mark's cheek. "Here in this space between us, it is safe." So Mark pressed up against his lover and only friend, and whispered into the space between them, where his cold body pressed against Kieran's warm one. "I am a shadow hunter. I am a shadow hunter. I am a shadow hunter." 13. With no other thought. Emma stood in front of the mirror in her bathroom, slowly peeling off her tank top. 20 minutes with a bottle of bleach had removed the blood from the inside of the Toyota. That was fine. She was used to bloodstains. But there was something more visceral about this, about Julian's blood dried on her skin, red-brown patches over her ribs and shoulder. As she unzipped her jeans and wriggled out of them, she could see the splatters of dried blood along the waistband, the telltale pinpricks of it up and down the seams. She balled up the jeans and top and threw them in the trash. In the shower, the water scalding hot, she scrubbed away the blood and dirt and sweat. She watched the water run pinkish down the drain. She couldn't count how many times that had happened, how often she'd made herself bleed during training and battles. Scars slashed across her midriff and shoulders, along her arms, at the backs of her knees. But Julian's blood was different. When she saw it, she thought of him, shot and crumpling, the way his blood had run like water through her fingers. It was the first time in years that she'd actually thought he might die, that she might lose him. She knew what people said about Parabatai, knew that it was meant to be a loss as profound as that of a spouse or a sibling. Emma had lost her parents. She had thought she knew what loss was prepared for it. But nothing had prepared her for the feeling that the idea of losing Jules wrenched out of her, that the sky would go dark forever, that there would never be solid ground again. Even stranger had been the feeling that had rushed through her when she realized he was going to be all right. She had become aware of his physical presence in a way that almost hurt. She had wanted to put her arms around him, to grab onto him with her fingers digging in as if she could press them together, hard enough to seal their skin, interlock their bones. She knew it didn't make sense, but she couldn't explain it another way. She just knew it was intense and painful, and a thing she hadn't felt about Julian before, and that it scared her. The water had gone cold. She spun the shower off with a savage twist of her wrist, stepped out, and toweled her hair dry. She found a clean camisole and boxer shorts folded on her laundry basket, and dressed, stepped out into her bedroom. Christina was sitting on her bed. "Whoa," Emma said, "I didn't know you were in here. I could have come out of the bathroom stark naked or something." "I doubt you have anything I don't have." Christina looked distracted. Her dark hair was down in braids. She was interweaving her fingers the way she did when she was preoccupied. "Is everything all right?" Emma asked, sitting down on the edge of the bed. "You look bothered." "Do you think Mark had friends in the Wild Hunt?" Christina asked abruptly. "No." Emma was taken aback. "At least he's never mentioned any." "And you'd think he would have, if there was someone he missed." She frowned. "Why?" Christina hesitated. "Well, he borrowed that motorcycle tonight from someone. I just hope he hasn't gotten himself in any trouble."
"Mark's clever," said Emma. "I doubt he bartered his soul for the temporary use of a motorbike or anything."
"I'm sure you're right," Christina murmured, and glanced toward Emma's wardrobe. "Can I borrow a dress?"
"Right now?" Emma said. "Have you got a midnight date?"
"No, for tomorrow night."
Christina got to her feet to peer into the wardrobe. Several badly folded rayon dresses fell out.
"It is meant to be formal. I didn't bring any formal dresses with me from home."
You won't fit into anything of mine, Emma said as Christina held up a black dress with a design of rockets and frowned at it. We're different shapes. You're way more boom-chicka-boom. Is that even English? Christina frowned, tossing the rocket dress onto a shelf and shutting the wardrobe door. I don't think that's English. Emma smiled at her. I'll take you shopping tomorrow, she said. Deal? That seems so normal. Christina smoothed her braids back. After tonight. Cameron called me, Emma said. I know, Christina said. I was in the kitchen. Why are you telling me now? Are you back together? Emma rocked backward on the bed. No, he was warning me. He told me that there were people who didn't want me investigating these murders. Emma, Christina sighed. And you didn't say anything to us? He said it about me, Emma said. I figured any danger would be my danger. But Julian got hurt, said Christina, knowing what Emma was going to say before she said it. So you're worrying it was your fault. Emma picked at the fringe on the edge of her blanket. Isn't it? I mean, Cameron warned me. He said he heard it at the shadow market. So I don't know if it was mundanes talking or fairies or warlocks or what. But the fact is he warned me and I ignored it. It was not your fault. We already know there's someone, a necromancer most likely, killing and sacrificing mundanes and downworlders. We already know he has an army of manta demons at his beck and call. It isn't as if Julian wasn't expecting and prepared for danger. He almost died on me, Emma said. There was so much blood. And you fixed him. He's fine. You saved his life. Christina waved a hand. Her nails were perfect, shining ovals, where Emma's were ragged from sparring and training. Why are you second-guessing yourself, Emma? Is it because Julian was hurt and that frightened you? Because you have taken risks since the first time I ever met you. It is part of who you are, and Julian knows that. He doesn't just know it, he likes it. Does he? He's always telling me not to risk myself. He has to, said Christina. You are the two halves of a whole. You must be different, like light and shadow. He brings you caution to temper your recklessness, and you bring him recklessness to temper his caution. Without each other, you would not function as well as you do. That is what parabatai means. She tugged lightly on the ends of Emma's wet hair. I do not think it is Cameron that is bothering you. That is just an excuse to berate yourself. I think it is that Julian was hurt. Maybe, said Emma in a tight voice. Are you sure you're all right? Christina's dark brown eyes were worried. I'm fine. Emma sat back against the pillows. She collected kitschy California pillows. Some looked like postcards, some were shaped like the state or said, I love Cali. You don't look fine, Christina said. You look like... My mother used to say there was a look people got when they realized something. You look like someone who has realized something. Emma wanted to close her eyes, to hide her thoughts from Christina, thoughts that were treacherous, dangerous, wrong to have. Just shock, she said. I came close to losing Julian, and it threw me off. I'll be fine tomorrow. She forced a smile. If you say so, Manita, Christina sighed. If you say so. After Julian cleaned himself up and washed the blood off, and arranged to send the shreds of his poison-burned gear jacket to Malcolm, he walked down the hall to Emma's room and stopped halfway. He'd wanted to lie down on the bed beside her and for them to talk over the night's events and to close their eyes together, with the sound of her breathing like the sound of the ocean measuring out the steps towards sleep. But when he thought of that night in the back of the car, of Emma hovering over him, panic on her face and blood on her hands, he didn't feel what he knew he should feel. Fear, the memory of pain, relief that he'd healed. Instead, he felt a tightening in his body that sent an ache down to the center of his bones. When he closed his eyes, he saw Emma in the witch light, her hair tumbling out of its fastening, the light of the street lamps shining through the strands and turning them to a sheet of pale summer-frozen ice. Emma's hair. Maybe because she took it down so rarely. Maybe because Emma with her hair down was one of the first things he'd ever wanted to paint, but the long, looping pale strands of it had always been like cords that connected directly to his nerves. His head hurt, and his body ached unreasonably, wanting to be back in that car with her. It made no sense, so he forced his steps away from her door, down the hall, to the library. It was dark in there and cold and smelled of old paper. Still, Julian didn't need a light. He knew exactly what section of the room he was headed toward. Law. Julian was pulling down a red-bound book from a high shelf when a reedy cry drifted down the hall. He grabbed hold of the tome and was out of the room in an instant, rushing down the corridor. He rounded the corner and saw Drusilla's door open. She was leaning out of it, witchlight in hand, her round face illuminated. Her pajamas were covered in a pattern of frightening masks.
"Tavi's been crying," she said. He stopped for a while, but then he started again.
"Thanks for telling me." He dropped a kiss on her forehead. "Go back to bed. I'll deal with it." Drusilla withdrew, and Julian slipped into Tavi's room, closing the door behind him. Tavi was a curled-up ball under the covers of his bed. He was asleep, his body curved around one of his pillows, his mouth open. Tears ran down his face. Julian sat down on the bed and put a hand on Tavi's shoulder.
"Octavian," he said, "wake up. You're having a nightmare. Wake up."
Tavi shot upright, his brown hair in wild disarray. When he saw Julian, he hiccuped and flung himself at his older brother, arms wrapping around his neck. Jules held Tavi and rubbed his back, gently patting the sharp knobs of his spine. "Too small, too skinny," his mind said. It had been a battle to get Tavi to eat and sleep ever since the Dark War. He remembered running through the streets of Alicante with Tavi in his arms, stumbling on the cracked paving, trying to keep his little brother's face mashed against his shoulder so he wouldn't see the blood and the death all around him, thinking that if they could just get through everything without Tavi seeing what was happening, it would be all right. He wouldn't remember. He wouldn't know. And still, Tavi woke up with nightmares every week, shaking and sweating and crying. And every time it happened, the dull realization that he hadn't really saved his baby brother at all went through Julian like spikes. Tavi's breaths evened out slowly as Julian sat there, arms around him. He wanted to lie down, wanted to curl up around his youngest brother and sleep. He needed rest so badly it was dragging at him, like a wave pulling him under and down. But he couldn't sleep. His body felt restless, unsettled. The arrow going into him had been agony. Pulling it out had been worse. He'd felt his skin tear in a moment of pure animalistic panic, the surety that he was going to die. And then what would happen to them? Livy and Ty and Drusilla and Tavi and Mark. And then Emma's voice in his ear and her hands on him, and he'd known he was going to live. He looked at himself now, the mark on his ribs entirely gone. Well, there was something there, a faint line of white against his tan skin, but that was nothing. Shadow hunters lived through scars. Sometimes he thought they lived for them. Unbidden in his mind rose the image he'd been trying to crush down since he'd returned to the Institute. Emma, in his lap, her hands on his shoulders, her hair like drifts of pale gold around her face. He remembered thinking that if he died, at least he would die with her as close to him as she possibly could be, as would ever be allowed by the law. As Tavi slept, Julian reached for the law book he'd taken from the library. It was a book he'd looked at so many times that it now always fell open to the same well-worn page. "On Paravatai," it said. "It is decreed that those who have undergone the ceremony of Paravatai and are forever bound by the terms of the oaths of Saul and David, of Ruth and Naomi, shall not enter into marriage, shall not bear children together, and shall not love each other in the manner of eros, but only in the manner of philia or agape. The punishment for the contravention of this law shall be at the discretion of the clave. The separation of the parabatai in question from each other, exile from their families, and should the criminal behavior continue, the stripping of their marks and their expulsion from the Nephilim. Never again shall they be shadow hunters. So it is decreed by Raziel. Sed lex, dura lex. The law is hard, but it is the law." When Emma came into the kitchen, Julian was by the sink, cleaning up the remains of breakfast. Mark was leaning against the kitchen island in dark jeans and a black shirt. With his new short hair, in the daylight, he looked astonishingly different from the ragged, feral boy who'd pushed back his hood in the sanctuary. She'd gone for a deliberately long run on the beach that morning, missing the family meal on purpose, trying to clear her head. She grabbed a bottled smoothie out of the refrigerator instead. When she turned around, Mark was grinning. "As I understand it, what I am currently wearing is not semi-formal enough for the performance tonight?" he inquired. Emma glanced from him to Julian.
So Mr. Rules unbent and decided you could come tonight? Julian gave a fluid shrug. I'm a reasonable man.
Ty and Livy have promised to help me find something to wear, said Mark, heading for the kitchen.